General Home, Reel 10. You were saying that there were a lot of talented men in the battalion because of the national service.
That's right. And we had a very good football team, for instance, you know, because... And I suppose it's applied to all units, really, at that time, national service. Talk about this. I had one bloke who was the assistant professional at some golf club in Hertfordshire. And I said to him, are you going to go in for the Far East, Far Elf Golf Championships in Singapore? And he said, no. I said, why not? He said, well, I haven't got any clubs. Well, I was in golf class. I said, you take mine. And my clubs, with him, won the competition. I mean, you know, and so that was great. This varied talent you had. Yeah.
You were saying, I think, earlier on that you flew back from Malaya when...
Well, I did.
The posting, the battalion posting.
Yes. We were going to Shoeburyness, transiting, before the battalion went to Northern Ireland for a tour in about June, I think.
Oh.
I think June or July. Mm. And I took the view that my time would be better used in sorting out things in England than staying on a troop ship. I had a very good second in command, and I thought he was quite capable of looking after the talon on the way home. And I thought in those days, I mean, air travel had come in, you know, certainly for individuals. And I thought if there was a crisis, I could have been flown back and joined the thing very quickly. And because we'd finished an overseas tour, there were going to be quite a lot of personnel changes in the battalion when we got home. And so that's what I did. I flew home, and I spent my time sort of with the record office and new camps, and we had a crisis with the bandmaster at that time who said he was going to leave, and, you know, and sorted all those things out. And I think that was right for me to do it. And in fact, it worked out all right, because the next time I saw the battalion, I met them at Southampton. And they'd had an uneventful voyage home. And I thought I had spent 4 weeks more profitably in England, sorting out the future in England, than administering the battalion on the way home. And I think the second in command enjoyed it too, because he was commanding the battalion for 4 weeks, basically, on the troop ship. I always wondered what would happen if something had blown up, because I don't think I ever asked anybody. I think I just did it. I can't remember. We had an Australian brigadier by that time. I don't think he'd have been bothered.
It's often said that what all officers really want to do is to command their own battalion.
That's right.
This is the summit of all ambition, and it's the best time. Do you think, looking back on it, this was the best?
I wouldn't agree with you that it's the summit of all ambition. I can think of very much more ambitions than a lot of other officers have than being a lieutenant colonel. Mm. But it's a very, very good time, because the battalion is yours to make or break. And if you make it, that's fine. And if you break it, the buck stops with you. And it doesn't stop with anybody else. And... yes, it's fine. A battalion, I think, CEO of a battalion is the best job.
The most enjoyable job,
And best, really. And best.
How does it compare with commanding a company?
No comparison, really. Mm. Because, I mean, a battalion is basically a unit, entity. And you're the boss. If you're a company, I mean, there are four or five other company commanders, and you know, and all responsible to the CEO. Mm. And the CEO is the battalion.
But if you're in a battalion, then arguably you're also part of a brigade, and you've got...
Oh, yeah, but he's a bit further away, isn't
he? Oh, is he?
Yeah, I mean, the brigadier is a little bit... Brigade headquarters is usually a few miles away in peacetime. And although, of course, he's responsible for his brigade, unless it is a really sort of disaster for which he's instigated or something... He's not basically responsible for what goes on internally in the battalion. I mean, it's the CO who the buck stops at his table.
How much freedom do you allow your company commanders when you're a battalion commander? Do you keep a grip of them, or do you let them get on with things?
Well, I always like to get on with them. get on with the things, get on with them, get on with them. I mean, I think one of your jobs is to make sure you've got good company commanders.
Mm.
And I've always believed provided you've got good subordinates, let them get on with it.
How did you spend your time when you were commanding the battalion? Were you mainly in your headquarters, or were you mainly out on the ground going round the companies?
I suppose you spent more time in your headquarters, but I suppose I was out and about about a third of the time, I should think. Visiting the women in the jungle, I used to go out with the companies in rotation. You used to get summoned to brigade headquarters and conferences, and then you had to go out and organise exercises and things. Yeah.
How did you conduct your business? Did you have conferences with your company commanders, or did you go around?
No, you used to have conferences. I don't think on any set basis.
Not a regular,
no.
Daily.
Nothing like that. Mm. Whether it was once a week or once, depends on what was going on.
Mm.
And of course, I was lucky, I had a very good adjunct all the time I was CO, and he did all the detailed administration and organisation.
Were there any tasks that you delegated to the 2IC on a regular basis, permanent basis?
Yes. I mean, I think he had. He took a lot of responsibility or for the planning, detailed planning and everything of the training. Mm. And he used to look after the band. I think being second in command is a pretty unsatisfactory job, because you're not the boss and you've really got no responsibility for what goes on.
Mm.
But you've got to try to be helpful and fill your time positively and so on. I used to try and give the second command as much as possible to do and be responsible for, I think.
When you were out visiting, who was back minding the shop?
Oh, he was, second command, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Who would you take with you if you went out on a visit or into the field?
Well, if you were planning an exercise and so on, I think you used to take the IO normally, intelligence officer. We had an intelligence officer. And I think he was mainly, and this happened in the war too, when the CO was out visiting or used to go to Brigade Court, it was always the IO he used to take.
Yep.
So the adjutant was back at home minding the shop with the second in command.
Did you do most of your work on paper, or did you do it by verbal communication, usually?
I think in a battalion you probably did as much as you could verbally. Mm. I mean, there was. I think the paperwork was more the adjutant thing with personnel problems and this, that, and the other. Yeah. We had a certain amount of written correspondence with higher headquarters.
Yes.
But I think you used to try and keep your written stuff within the battalion down to a minimum, and I think the minimum was quite enough.
And could you rely on were your company commanders at that time, were they war experienced men,
yes.
Mostly?
I'm not sure they were.
It's now 15 years since the end of the war.
Mm. Some were. Mm. I think some were and some weren't.
Mm.
Yes. Yes, I don't think they all were.
Mm. I mean, if you expressed your general intentions, could you rely upon them generally to understand the implications of the detail?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Mm. I was lucky. I had good company one. I had a good set of officers.
Mm. You inherited those from your predecessor?
Yes. I'm trying to think. We still had a depot, of course. There were separate, still infantry regimental depots. And the infantry divisional system, of course, hadn't come in. But I think there was a sort of three-way thing. I think with the CO, the depot commander, and the record office, Officer in Charge of Records, was it record? Or the military secretary, I forget. But who sort of organised and arranged the officer posting. And as a CO, you had quite a big input into this. I can remember, no names, but I can remember saying there were one or two officers of whom I'd had previous knowledge, of whom I said I won't have them in the battalion. So, you know, and that washed. Everybody said, okay. And then when I had a second in command who left after about 9-10 months when I'd been part of the battalion, who went back to the Kenya, to the African Rifles, or whatever it was called.
KAR. African Rifles.
Because he had served in them previously, and he'd done a lot of regimental duty in our regiment. And before I arrived, he had put in an application to go back to the KAR, and that eventually came through. And I then let it be known who I wanted to be second in command. And this chap, who I'd known before, had a staff job in England, and he was removed early from his staff job to come out as our second in command. So we had quite a big input. And the authorities in England treated COs' demands or requests quite seriously, I think, and were very helpful, I found.
The other key personnel are your warrant officers, aren't they? The company sergeant majors, the regimental sergeant majors.
RSM,
major.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, did you have an influence upon their appointments? And
well, not so much. When I arrived, they were all very good blokes, and sergeant majors aren't they, on the whole? I mean, here, they're marvellous, aren't they, the sergeant majors and people? But I was very lucky indeed. I found, when I arrived in the battalion, RSM, who just suited me down to the ground. He'd been a soldier in the Coldstream Guards originally, and then I don't know why he'd transferred at some stage in his career. I suspect because promotion in the Guards was more difficult. He'd transferred to the Essex Regiment, and he'd eventually worked himself up, and I had him, the RSM, was the whole time I was in command. And he was a very quiet-spoken, intelligent chap, and a great disciplinarian in a very quiet sort of way, and every soldier in the battalion respected him. He never bawled them out, you know. But so that was very lucky for me. And he was eventually commissioned and finished up as a major.
Yeah. I was going to ask you what qualities you looked for in your senior NCOs, your warrant officers, and what are the essential qualities of a good...
Well, leadership, really, isn't it, at that stage? I mean... And experience, to be a sergeant major at that time, I expect it's still the same. You have to be a pretty experienced bloke, come up through the ranks, you know it all. Loyal, intelligent. I didn't like the loud-mouthed chap at all. And I don't think I can't remember we had any of them. I mean, and they were so. And one thing, of course, in the RSM's case, he's responsible for running the sergeant's mess. And you want a chap who can run a very good sergeant's mess. Because if you've got that, half your problems are over, aren't they?
Indeed.
Yeah.
You're also saying that you were choosy about what officers you wanted in the battalion.
Well, only, yes, well, that was my personal, because I had personal knowledge of
yes.
some. Half the officers, about half, I suppose, when I arrived in the battalion, I did not know, because they'd come from the beds and hearts.
Yes.
But as I said earlier, I made it quite clear to everybody when I arrived, I didn't care where they'd come from.
But I mean, what did you look for in a company commander? I mean, what are the qualities you required there for a chap to be a good company commander?
Well, he had to be a leader, didn't he, really? And in our first bit, in of course, when we were still operating in the jungle, he had to be a good leader operationally. And he had to be a good man-manager, too. I mean, that's one of the keys, isn't it? And I suppose it's all part of leadership. And they haven't got to be thick, have they? I mean, they mustn't be thick. But I was very lucky. At least I thought, looking back on it, I mean, I had some really good officers. Mm. I had one or two, not so good, but they were more captains and subalterns, I think. Mm. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, why was it that these chaps, without naming names, that you didn't want in the... battalion. I mean, what was it about them that you...
Well, I remember one particular bloke who I first met when we went back. He came out to Dortmund after he'd come back from Hong Kong. And I didn't think that his approach to soldiers was right. I heard him shouting and bawling at them in the most dreadful way, I thought. And I thought, I'm not having that bloke. I don't think it was unfair to him. I don't think he ever knew. Well, I don't think he could have known, you see, and they didn't want him to know. But he wasn't my type.
Mm. So what is the best way of maintaining discipline? If, you know, I mean, there is a tradition of shouting in certain branches of the army, isn't there?
I don't say that our sergeant majors and sergeants never shouted, but then I hope they only did it with good reason. Mm. The last thing I wanted was a bloke who couldn't talk properly to the soldiers, you know, sort of off-duty times and so on.
Yes.
And they're very cute soldiers are, really, and NCOs, at catching on to what the CO wants. You know, I mean, and you can soon... I like to think you can impress your own personality on the battalion quite early on. I'm not really good at talking about leadership, but I mean, I could write an essay on it, I suppose, if I took a lot of trouble about it.
But when you came back, I think you did you say you were at Shoebury now?
Yeah, just staging.
That was a total transit camp.
Yeah, and I don't think we did much there. I think, you see, when they came back from Allah, everybody had a month or 5 weeks leave. Mm. And then I was preparing to hand over. And I suspect that the boys came back from leave March. Mm. And
they went to
Ireland in May, I think.
What were they going to do in Ireland?
Oh, well, now this was... 62, there was a brigade garrison, wasn't there, in Ireland? Mm. So, that, I mean, internal security, I suppose, was their job, but they were the brigade stationed in Northern Ireland. And, of course, the troubles, they hadn't begun, had they, the real troubles?
No, that came later.
So that, I suppose they did a two-year stint as a garrison battalion in Northern Ireland. Mm. Mm. But I'd handed over by then, I didn't go to Northern Ireland. Mm.
Yeah, I think you went to Warminster.
I did. Mm. I went to Warminster. Mm.
What were you doing there?
I was commanding a thing called the All Arms Tactics Wing. Oh. Up to that time, Warminster had been exclusively the School of Infantry. Mm. And the Director of Infantry, and I suppose other arms directors in the War Office, had decided that the different arms had got to get more together in training. And so they instituted a thing called the All Arms Division at the School of Infantry. Mm. And I was put in. We had two courses we had to run. All Arms Tactics Wing, that's what I commanded.
Yes.
And we had under it the Platoon Commander's Wing, which was exclusively infantry training, and then the All Arms Tactics Wing. And the All Arms Tactics Wing had, as instructors, people from all the fighting arms, and the students were also gunners, tanks, sappers, infantry. And this was, it was set up, this thing, just to, the first course was at the end of 1962.
And what level were they? These were not
majors,
platoon commanders. Major. It's company commander level.
Yeah, company squadron commander level.
Yes.
And
how long did the course in All Arms Tactics last?
3 or 4 months, I think. Mm. I think 3 months, perhaps.
Mm. What sort of things were they doing?
Well, it was, having been an instructor at the Staff College, it was very much, exercises, the things were very much similar to that, except, and the course was very similar, except there was much more emphasis on outdoor toots than there was on indoor map studies. And we used to have, certainly at the end of the course, but there was a tank squadron based in Warminster, and there was a demonstration battalion in Warminster, and we used to run exercises too for the students, you know, and they had command appointments in these exercises using the resident troops at Warminster. So I like to think it was a good course. It was only beginning, and I was only at Warminster for a year, basically.
And did you have them play a major part in developing the course?
No.
Your design?
Well, I suppose I was, in theory, responsible for it. But again, you see, there was an all-arms divisional commander.
Yeah.
Who was a very good chap called Jackie Harmon, who eventually became a full general.
Queen's Dragoon Guards.
That's right. And he was setting up this course in detail.
Yes.
And the last thing he wanted to do was to be interfered with too much by me at that time. Mm. And I used to take a great interest in this. Mm. And I used to, you know, commandants do. I do opening and closing addresses and used to go out with them on some of their exercises. And hopefully be of help rather than a critic too much.
Where had Jackie Harmon got the idea from then? I mean, what was
his inspiration? Well, he'd just been appointed.
He'd been told, how do you get on with this?
Yeah, he'd been appointed to run this new course. Mm. And it was quite a job. All these instructors were all new. It was a new thing put together.
Yes.
And I think it turned out pretty well. I don't know if they still do that sort of thing, almost what it is. But and I handed over, after a year, to a gunner officer, who then commanded the all-arms tactics wing at the School of Infantry.
Mm. What about the platoon commander's course? What did that...
That was purely infantry. Mm. Purely infantry. And it had been running for ever since the war, I suppose, or when Warminster was set up as the School of Infantry. I don't quite know when that was. And it ran on oiled wheels pretty well.
How long was that course?
8 weeks, was it? So week. I don't think it was as long as the All Arms Tactics week. I don't think.
And what was the content of the syllabus that they were being taught?
Minor infantry tactics, basically. A platoon level, basically, but I think they used to do company exercises as well.
Were all the students on that course infantry?
Yeah, and some overseas students, some overseas. I remember.
You didn't have anyone from other arms?
No. But what we did have in the headquarters of the... You see, I was at the wing headquarters, and we had these two divisional courses running under them. And at my wing headquarters, we had representatives or an officer from tanks, signals, sappers. You know, we had the nucleus at the wing headquarters too. And we used to get involved in other things outside Warminster. We used to have to go and do... presentations at Lark Hill, for instance, for their gunner course.
Yes.
And I can remember it was then the Imperial Defence College. I remember they once came down to Warminster and we had to put on a presentation for them. Well, I was able to use the officers in my headquarters to help me laying all this on without bothering the chaps running the courses too much. Yeah.
It sounds as though it was really becoming a centre of study and instruction as well as running courses.
Yeah.
If you were going out from... was the idea that this would become a place where ideas about the employment of infantry in conjunction with other arms would be developed and
tested? I hope so.
That's a rather experimental function, isn't
it? Yeah, in a way. Mm. We were also, you see, it was still called the School of Infantry, I think, although we ran this all-arms course.
Yes.
And we were very much the baby of the Director of Infantry.
Who was that at that time?
I think it was a fellow called Paul Gladel, was it? Gladel? I think a General Gladel, I think. Mm. Yeah. But he used to come down occasionally and have conferences with us and so on and discuss things.
Thinking about the tactics that you were teaching there at that time, had there been any major development since the end of the Second World War?
No, I don't think so. A great deal. Mm. I don't think so. I think there was more emphasis on minor tactics.
Mm.
And minor tactics really haven't changed, have they, over the ages? Fire movement.
They are the two basic principles.
Yeah.
Yep.
At any level.
And what about the all-arms tactics? I mean, were there any developments going on there?
No, much as I remember it. I mean, in the war, really.
Mm.
But, of course, in the war, certainly in our campaign in Northwest Europe, it became a matter of second nature to us to operate with tanks and gunners and everything else because we had so much to do.
Mm.
And that... you had to keep that alive, and
yes.
Because the separate arms up to this time had rather gone their own way in training.
Mm. Well, that always tends to happen in peacetime, doesn't it? That they're getting on with honing their own particular two-arm skills, and they're rather forgetting the broader weave of what's going on.
Yeah.
Where did you get your instructors from for the all arms?
Oh, I think each arm was told to produce a chap. Mm. You know, the gunners were saying produce a chap. Mm. And we had one or two failures, I remember.
What brought
well,
those on?
I think the other arms had agreed to this course, whether rather grudgingly in some cases, and I think certainly in one case I can remember particularly, they had sent a chap to instruct who wasn't of the right calibre. And the commandant of the School of Infantry was a brigadier, and you see he was my boss. And it became clear, really, to all of us that he wasn't quite up to it. I think this was in the first course. And he got on to whichever arm it was, to the director, and said, "Oi, you know, send us a proper chap," which they did.
And after that, then, I think you were off to...
I went to Bahrain.
To Bahrain, yes. Was that a surprise posting for
you? Yeah, very. Had to look it up on the map, you know, almost, you know, one of those places. And we had a fascinating nearly 3 years there.
What was there in Bahrain when you arrived to take command?
Well, I'll tell you what we had. I had a grandiose title of Commander Land Forces Persian Gulf. Now, to start with, the boss in the Persian Gulf was a fellow called the political resident, who was a Foreign Office man. And I was under him. I had a military boss in Aden, but the political resident in Bahrain was very much independent of Aden.
Which one was more important?
Well, to me, the chap in Bahrain. I mean, the political resident, really. Although, my boss, I mean, we kept in close touch, and he used to come up and visit us, make sure we were running things properly. And that was fine because the political resident was a marvellous bloke called Sir William Luce, who had been in the colonial office most of his time and spent most of his time in the Sudan. And he ranked, actually, as a 5-star ambassador. He was a very senior bloke. And he was a great chap. And we all learnt a tremendous amount from him. And he ran what you might call a very happy ship in Bahrain, in the Gulf. And this was entirely due to him. Now, I had, in Bahrain, my title was more grandiose than actually what we called. We had a parachute battalion in Bahrain, and we also had a tank landing squadron.
Tank landing squadron?
Which was under the Royal Navy. It was under operational control of the Royal Navy.
Was it under your command in any way?
Well, only that if there was a problem, a military soldier's problem, with them, then I might have got involved. But I really had no control over what they did day by day. And so we had in Bahrain a parachute battalion and a squadron of tanks. You see, and they were, I think they were embarked on this whatever
tank
ship it
squadron.
Was. Well, I forget what kind of boat it was. Under a lieutenant, a commander, wasn't he? Lieutenant commander or commander? We had what we called the Kuwait Liaison Team, which was a small training team in Kuwait. Well, I don't know if it was training, but we had... it was liaising with the Kuwaiti armed forces, such as they were. And it had up there a stockpile of British tanks. We had a stockpile of British tanks in Kuwait. I think it was only a squadron's worth. And down further south, there was the Truchleimer Scouts. Now, the Truchleimer Scouts was quite a big force. In theory, that was under the command of the political resident in Bahrain, because it was really financed by the Foreign Office. But he rather left it to me to conduct the military side of the troop, what they did. We used to run exercises for them, and I used to visit them quite regularly, the True Flame Scouts. So that was them, and they were commanded by a full colonel of ours. And they were...